Welcome to The Voice of Florida Architecture, the podcast of AIA Florida. I'm your host, Rhonda Hammond, AIA. As architects, we are fundamentally trained to solve problems with an extensive education that balances art and science. Architects are uniquely equipped to design solutions to a variety of problems that we see in our collective built environment. Today's cities face complex challenges that require strong leadership, multi-sector partnerships, and interdisciplinary solutions to create lasting change. Some of the biggest issues faced by cities across the globe include climate change, affordable housing, public safety, and health disparities. Architects can help. This is an excerpt from AIA National's 2024 president, Kimberly Dowdell, introducing her Chief Architect Initiative. She went on to say, "A chief architect would serve as a key advisor to mayors and city managers in places where such expertise is missing. The chief architect position has the potential to revive the public's understanding of the value that architects offer. Additionally, the heightened attention to design excellence is something that our cities need. AIA Florida has its own chief architect that can share the impact this position can have on our communities. Our distinguished guest today is Mr. Tim Johnson, AIA, Chief Architect for the City of Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Tim, to the podcast, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited about our time today. I'm looking forward to sharing whatever I can and talking about what I do.
Tim also serves on the board AI Florida's State Director for AIA Orlando. Tim and I also share an alma mater. We both are graduates from FAMU School of Architecture, right?
That's correct, yes.
Before we get into the business of being Chief Architect, Tim, as has become tradition, will you share your journey, your story of becoming an architect?
I grew up in a little small town, North Florida, called Alachua, right in the shadows of Gainesville, Florida. And it's a farming community. My mom was a school teacher. My dad was a pastor of a church, and he ran his own business. In seventh grade, I discovered drafting in my industrial arts class, and I thought it was pretty neat and really liked it and wanted to develop that skill a little bit more because my dad did some drafting when he was in the Air Force, and he would show me some of the drawings he had to produce. And oddly enough, I remember being at home at five years old, and my dad was where he worked at night, so he stayed home during the day with me at that point in my life. And he had me writing my letters, showed me how to write all of my alphabets, of course, and how to write them. And he wanted them straight up and down or either on a slant. And then he taught me, I remember being 5 years old, he taught me how to write, do your letters slanted. That way you're not worried about them being vertical all the time. And then I remember doing that. That was pretty neat. And he spent a lot of time with me doing that. And if Professor Jerry Hicks is listening to this podcast, he's not going to believe that because he was very critical of my handwriting. But anyway, I remember going to the pharmacy, the drugstore, we called it, and picking up different handbooks on house plans and things of that magnitude. And the thing that really impacted my journey was my parents. The home we grew up in was a Jim Walter house. I'm not sure what that is, but my dad always referred to it as a Jim Walter house. It was a one bath, three bedroom house with a small living space. As we grew older, my sister and I, and then when my brother came along, my parents added and added and added and added some more. Today, that one bathroom, three bedroom house is a six bedroom, four bathroom home, two-car garage, and it sits on an acre. And I would come home from school and watch people building on it and just be fascinated by the fact that they could get walls to stand up and roofs to be on top and things of that magnitude. And it's a pretty solid house right now. It just impacted me greatly to the point that I all of a sudden wanted to start drawing things that looked like that. So that's what drew me into architecture. And then in high school, I took a drafting class, mechanical drafting, of course, in 11th grade. I was so inspired by it, I bought my own drafting table, which was a portable drafting table that flipped over. It had a slide rule on it and bought all of the scales and the triangles and You name it. I didn't deal with a T-square, believe it or not. I had a parallel bar way back then. And I carried that all the way with me until one day my wife and I decided it had exceeded its useful life in the garage, so I had to throw it away. But that's what led me to this path of architecture. I like putting stuff together. My sister reminds me all the time of how I would take her watch apart, not my own, her watch apart, and try to put it back together. But I was fascinated by how things went together. And that's what did it for me.
So early in your career, you owned and operated your own firm too, right?
Yes, I did. So in 1991, I decided to go out on my own. I had some contractor friends who had houses and small commercial buildings they wanted done. Believe it or not, that was in 91. But in 1983, while in college, my dad's church needed an addition done, and I did the drawing. Today, I still don't know how they built it, but it's built, and it was a successful build, but that was in 1983. It was before I graduated college. And so I felt like I could do it. And 91, I went out on my own and started going after a lot of work with churches and small commercial, did a restaurant here and there. And of course, a lot of, as my good dear friend Lee Menicus would say, a lot of Florida room additions.
So you're also a part of NoMA. Share your thoughts on supporting this group of architects.
NoMA is one of those groups. Believe it or not, we grew into NoMA. I moved here in order to Orlando in 1988, and the only person I knew when I moved here literally was Ruffin Rhodes. Ruffin and I had gone to school together, and we knew each other. And when I moved to Orlando, I called him, and he Ruffin being the genuine person that he is, he offered to get me an interview with the firm that he was working for. I ended up getting a job the first interview I had back in 1988. First interview, walked in, first week I was in town. I mean, I was just stoked, couldn't believe it. They offered me a job, little old me. As time went on, more and more people moved here from Florida A&M, from different schools, Tuskegee and the like. And we all began to meet each other and we would go to lunch. And this was back in 1998. We would have lunch on a monthly basis. We'd get together and just break bread, all of the minority architects. And we decided one day that we were going to join NoMA. We did. We put the package together and submitted it to NoMA. And we finally got our charter in 2006. There were enough of us licensed at that point in time. And we were able to really kind of figure out how we wanted to operate as an organization. But NoMA ends up being one of those organizations that gives small aspiring architects who really don't know a whole lot a path forward, almost like WIA. We are very co collegial, very cordial with each other, supportive of each other. That's the group that's going to come to your rescue if you're in trouble with a project. I'll never forget, I had a project and I was falling behind and I didn't have enough technical staff at that point in time. And I'll never forget Max Brito, before he became a part of Rhodes Brito, came over and spent a couple of evenings with me, just helping me get that project out the door. And it was just so inspiring. Max and Ruffin were classmates and just great guys. I'm so proud of their success today and really, really happy for them. But that's what NoMA is all about. That's what the whole team is about. Just a group of people that want to support each other, help each other. And in no way are we in competition with each other. That's what's really interesting about it. And so on a national level, I've talked to people in many states and different provinces. I have a buddy of mine. As a matter of fact, two of my NoMA colleagues called me before they accepted the job as city architects. One of them is a county architect. And the other young lady is a city architect, but she actually works for Temple. They both called me and asked me, what's it like? What's it like? I gave them my thoughts and they're off and they're happy that they made the move like I did.
So you've recently been promoted to city architect, and but your title includes deputy director at Economic Development Department.
Well, so let me share with you how this all came about. So when I joined the city here in 2002, and let me give you the whole story. So a dear friend of mine, Sarah Kelly, stopped me at the Citrus Club one day and asked me would I be interested in the position with the city. And Max and Ruffin and I were all working on the FAMU College of Law. And I was going to Citrus Club to meet with some folks to talk about the expansion of our business efforts to gain more work. We were going after a community center, and we had the FAMU College of Law under our belts, and we had one more project we were trying to get. So anyway, walk in and Sarah stops me and she made me promise that I would talk to Frank Billingsley, who's a retired chief of staff here at the city. I called Frank that day after he'd called me five times. And I went through five interviews with him and got the job. I was replacing another architect by the name of Ken Austin. Ken was a dear friend of mine. He and I had worked on a few projects here in the city over the years. In fact, he actually gave me some work here at the city. I came into a role called project manager. Mayor Dyer came into office and they wanted to change that title to city architect. So I wrote that title and became the first city architect here in Orlando. I enjoyed doing that. I then got promoted to division manager of permitting services, an organization that had all of the building and some of the land development functions under it and inspections. So I moved into that role for about 13 and a half years. And then I got promoted to deputy director. Deputy director, my role was to continue working with large scale developments, Universal, the airport, Tavistock, which one you may not have heard of, but they're a large developer here in Orlando. And then it grew into the hospitals. I got Orlando Health and Advent Health, and now Creative Village, the Packing District, and Air Commerce. All of those are large scale developments. Mayor Dyer's desire was to have those large developers have an easy path to success with permits. And that's the role that I fulfilled. What also happened was we decided there wasn't going to be another city architect for a while. So there was one city architect behind me, and I'm not sure how long he stayed, but he stayed a little while and then he left. One day they asked me, they said, you know, we really like that title, city architect, because we think you fulfilled it. And I said, I'd love to have it back. So creatively, they decided, okay, you can remain in the title as deputy director, but you can also use the title city architect. And so that's why I'm back to the role of city architect, because kind of back to my humble beginnings. And one of the new roles that this title carries is now why I kind of monitor larger the developments that are in their infancy. As they're beginning to ramp up, they come and talk to our ARB and urban design staff. And I sit through some of those meetings and I interject. And my job really is to make sure that those developments have as smooth a path as possible to success. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. I have to tell them the good and the bad and the ugly. But the best of all is I look at it this way. They're investing in our city, and we should do everything we can to make sure that they have all of the best available tools and knowledge from previous projects and developments so that they can be successful. And that's simply it. I want to make sure that they get all of the available information. There's a guy here by the name of Doug Spencer, and I'm tooting my own horn here. Doug Spencer used to work for Orlando Utilities Corporation. One day he came in to see me and he says, you know, the county has this and other communities have liaisons and people like that, but nobody's got Tim Johnson like Orlando. And I said, Doug, that is one of the best compliments I've ever heard. And he said, man, there's nobody like you. And I heard it again recently. The folks at Orlando Health told me they're looking for a champion like myself in other communities that they're expanding into. So my goal is just simply to make things happen. Where there's a blockage, a logjam, I get involved and I try to make that go away and try to help the developer. I mean, they're investing money. We want them to do that. Why not have somebody in place to try to make things move along as swiftly as they can and as economical for everyone, all parties concerned? So that's my job.
I foresee a workshop where Tim educates those that might be interested in this type of a position, a chief architect.
I'd love to do it. Rhonda, I don't know how you knew, but you read my syllabi already. I started doing that, and I love working with young architects because I can kind of give them some background on things I need to be aware of and care about, the things they need to care about as they're growing in young professions and their businesses. You know, it's what I said the other day, architecture is a profession, but it's also a business. And we have to look at it as such. And if we're not looking at it as a business, then we're missing something. That's the missing piece to all of this. But I enjoy being able to move from being the design professional over to the code official. As a part of my job here at the city, when I was director of division manager for permitting services, I served for 3 years as the building official as well. Volume had gone down and the building official retired and we didn't have anyone available immediately. So I stepped into that role, got a provisional license from the state of Florida, and was able to successfully move our operation forward for 3 years as the division manager and building official. And I will tell you, I don't want to go back to that role.
I was going to ask you, how did serving in that role, did it change how you operated in your other roles? Did it
Yes,
impact them?
It did. I was not looking at design at all. Those 3 years, I was purely focused on permits and how does it meet code. We do a lot of equivalencies here at the city of Orlando, and I leaned heavily upon a fire protection engineer that I had on board as a staff member and a chief building plans examiner, chief inspector. I leaned heavily upon a lot of people. And so it was a collaboration. And so I had to do a lot of delegating, a lot of being the ringmaster, so to speak. At the end of the day, it all stopped at my door. And I tried to keep my door open as much as I possibly could. But it was a lot of work just doing both roles, reporting to the state, making sure all of our business matters were in order. It was a lot to do. And during that time period, one of the things I did was I attended all of the building commission meetings so that I could have a leg up on what was coming and I could ask questions and rely upon that group as a resource.
How can AIA Florida, how can the components around the state help support this kind of initiative? People being involved at the city, county level?
I think one of the things that I advocate most, and this is the part that I didn't talk about. Before I came to work here at the city, I served for 7.5 years as the vice chair of the nominating committee. That is one of the city's citizen committees. That board was the board that would nominate you to other boards, like the Downtown Development Board, the Municipal Planning Board, the Code Enforcement Board. And so I got a chance from the inside to kind of see who's applying. Not many architects apply for those boards. And one of the things that our components around the state could do would be to advocate that our members get involved locally with our, what I call community boards, the city boards, the state boards. The one that I really have a real passion for is any board that deals with education. So I was chairman of the school advisory council for the Mid-Florida Technical School, which is a tech school. It's kids in high school and some adults. I served as the chair for 2 years. I moved from there to being the school advisory council, the SAC chairman for 3.5 years at my kids' school. And then when my kids moved out of that school, I got on the board of the charter school that my kids attended. And I was on that board for 6 years. And so education is one of those passion points for me. And even when I had my own business, I would routinely go out and do the presentations at schools for kids to talk about what it is to be an architect. I will never forget one of the first times I did it. I was at a high school and there were two of us doing a presentation. The kids asked me, how much money does an architect make? I felt sort of bad, but I didn't. I was like, okay, I guess that's reality. There was a police officer giving his presentation about becoming a patrol officer. And I'll tell you, he made $6,000 more than I did. And it was like shocking at first, but then I realized, I said, well, at least I'm not sitting there waiting for somebody to shoot bullets at me. So that's the only consolation I had on that. But yeah, we are not compensated accurately, and that's a long, long, long story. But yeah, I enjoyed doing those teach-ins and carry a kid to work day. My boys always loved coming to my office when I was in practice. So yeah, a lot
Did
of
any of
fun.
your children follow you in your footsteps? Follow in your footsteps?
No, unfortunately, no. Now all three are grown now, and I have one that's a missionary, one is a HR and marketing person, and then I have a daughter who's very technical. She's a chemistry, I call her a lab rat, but she's a chemist. Yeah, she loves chemistry, so that's kind of good. Happy
Know
about
you're very proud.
it. I am very proud of my kids. I am.
I want to circle back to NOMA. So
Yes.
you're one of the founding members of the Orlando chapter, is that right?
Yes, I am a
Is
founding member of NOMA Orlando.
Orlando is was Orlando the first chapter in Florida?
Very first chapter in the state of Florida. At that point in time, we represented all the members that joined NOMA from Tallahassee to Miami. After we had the NOMA conference here in 2007, I decided that I would run for the regional vice president for NOMA. And I served in that capacity for 4 years. And I had a goal of expanding chapters. And so I started right here in my own state. And we were able to get SoFlo NOMA, the South Florida chapter, up and running. But I also identified other areas where NOMA chapters needed to be started. The other one was NOFLO NOMA up in Jacksonville area, the North Florida chapter. And I got one more to get done. And they're dragging their feet, but I'm going to get them there. And that's the Tampa Bay area. We need to get those guys on board and move it forward. We were able to grow a few other chapters out of state because the Southeast Quadrant, which I was a regional VP of for 4 years, is probably the largest quadrant. We go from Virginia all the way over to Texas and all points in between, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, you name it. Houston is a large chapter. And now there's like three chapters in Texas. So yeah, but it was a lot of fun and it was a lot of work and a lot of responsibility, but I had help. I had a lot of help. A lot of help from the folks here and around the region to help out. And that was a benefit as well as a chore.
So your home component, talking about collaborating, is AIA Orlando, who was just awarded the Anthony Tony Pallara Chapter Award, which honors components that strive to exceed core member services as established by AIA and its members' expectations, particularly in the areas of public awareness and outreach, political effectiveness, and membership development. Tell us about AIA Orlando.
AIA Orlando is a very vibrant and alive organization. And it starts at the top, as you well know, Rhonda. We have a fantastic president in Alex Strawn. Alex is a legacy. His mother and father, both architects. His mother was the first female to be a president in Orlando. He has a lot of support, and not only a lot of support, but he has all of our ear, and we support every initiative that he's started. So he has pushed us to the digital platform, which is great. He has helped us to secure a space during the pandemic. Of course, like a lot of businesses, we had to kind of cut back. And so we moved out of our office in downtown, which was on the north end of town. We closed the office and everybody went virtual. But Alex has gotten us back to a point and a place where we're going to be moving in early next year, hopefully, into our new home in downtown Orlando, even closer to the core of things. And I think that's fantastic. We've increased, as you could see by our FAPAC participation, we were able to increase that money. We also have a new event called Pull for Clay, the Clay Shoot. The other thing that we do is we have the golf tournament every year, and I chair that. And one of the things I've done is try to make sure we had a consistent chair. So I've been chairing it. This will be my 5th year coming up, and I'm trying to groom the next generation of leaders who will come behind me and not only do it for 1 year, but do it for 5 years or 6 years, whatever have you. But AIA Orlando is on the move. We're trying to make our presence known in downtown. Our foundation is growing and thriving. I think we're We're moving some things there. I've introduced a couple other things I won't talk about, but we're going to see some new things coming out of AIA Orlando, and I'm really excited about it. Our membership is up. We're not as many members as Miami, but we have the largest number of architects, and I think that's important. And so we're going to continue to grow that. We're pushing all of our younger members to get licensed, to be a member, to be a part. It's working. It's working for our good. And I think that energy from Alex, you can feel it when you're in the room with him. And that's a wonderful thing. And I'm even excited about our next president, president-elect, which is Lindsay Perez, another exciting person. So we're riding high right now. We just got to keep that move going.
I met Alex back at Legislative Day this year, and his enthusiasm was just phenomenal.
Yes.
And when we interviewed AIA Orlando here on the podcast, it was just phenomenal listening to him.
Yes.
And we also know Lindsay Perez, and she too is
Yes.
very enthusiastic and passionate about what she does. So
Absolutely.
Tim, you've had a phenomenal career, one of service and leadership and being a role model. You've been an AIA member for several years. Tell us why membership in AIA is important to you.
Membership in AIA is important because it is your place to be refreshed, to be renewed, to be revived, and also to lean in and lean on those who have the experience and the knowledge and the know-how and gain that information and knowledge. I'll tell you, not having AIA is going to be tough for anyone trying to practice or be in business as an architect. And so it is the one area that I say we should absolutely promote because it helps you to grow, it helps you to survive, it helps you to thrive as an architect. Going through school is great. You get the education, you get that background, but now you've got to put it into use. And AIA Orlando is here to help you do that and be the very best architect you can be. And the public depends on us. And we have to remind ourselves of that. We have a public face, and that public is depending on us to give them the best advice, the best of everything, and to keep them safe. So it is an absolute must. And I wouldn't be where I am without AIA. Let me just also drop in here. Little known history, but I found a letter the other day from 1981. I keep mail that long, yes. And it was a letter from AIA National, and they were letting me know that I was one of 20 scholarship recipients from AIA National when I was at FAMU. And that scholarship, I was able to get it for 4 years. It was a beautiful scholarship. It was great. It meant that I didn't have to do a whole lot of outside work, I call it, to be in college. My parents had two kids in college at the same time, and so things were kind of thin, but that helped get me over the top. And I am so grateful, and I'll never, ever, ever forget AIA for that support. And I challenge anyone interested in being an architect to go look at that scholarship, apply for it, and you might be lucky enough to get it. I was so blessed to be able to get it, and I will never forget it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for being here today and sharing your story with us and for
Thank
helping
you.
us understand the benefit of a chief architect. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you, Rhonda, and all of the staff. You guys do so much. You don't get enough recognition. And I have to tell you, I think we have to do more to recognize the people that support us. So thank you, Becky. Thank you, Chrissy. Thank you, Elizabeth, as the president this year. And I'm looking forward to working with Adam Gale out of Gainesville, my homeboy, I call him. So we're looking forward to kind of chopping it up a little bit and doing more things here in Florida. Thank you so much for having me on.
I hope our listeners have enjoyed the conversation with Tim Johnson, AIA, sharing his role as Chief Architect of Orlando. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please share that others may hear our stories. You can find us wherever you stream your podcast. This is Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your host. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Voice of Florida Architecture.